Not flying, we haven't,
said one of the men.
Nor a flying girl, neither.
It was an unheard-of display of impudence, but Stutch saw that the man spoke for the others. Fearing a mutiny, he forced his voice to stay calm, asking the man,
What's your name, son?
Simmons,
said the man.
Simmons,
Stash said gently, making a mental note to kill Simmons when he was no longer needed.
I admit it ain't usual to see a flying croc, nor a flying girl, but I know what's doing it. It has to do with this treasure we're after, see? It has great power, it does. The power to make people fly, and more. Power is better than gold, men. Much better than gold. With the power this treasure gives you, you can have all the gold you want for the taking. That's what we're after, men. And once we get that chunk, you'll all be sharing in it. And if you believe that, you're as stupid as you look,
he added to himself. He saw he had the men's interest now, having brought their minds back to the treasure, having shown the connection between it and the things they'd seen. He pressed his advantage.
Now, look, he said. That old croc is gone now, and them savages is run off into the jungle, most of them, except that old man out there. There ain't nothing between us and that wall, and there ain't nothing behind that wall now except children. And I got a feeling the treasure's right near by them somewhere. It's right here, men. Right in our hands.
The men were nodding. He had them now.
All right, then, said Stash. Grab your swords and...
He stopped, seeing the expressions on the men's faces suddenly change as their gazes shifted to something behind him. He whirled, looked, and cursed. Now the children, holding hands, were rising slowly into the jungle sky. Chapter 54. Slank's Plan.
Port, Slank said. No, port is left, idiot, that way.
Little Richard, who despite years at sea could never get the port starboard thing straight in his mind, corrected course. The huge man was rowing the dory, with Slank in the stern. They were towing Black Stash's longboat, in which sat the battered wooden trunk. Little Richard, at Slank's order, had carried the trunk from the cave. He'd been reluctant at first, fearful of the following she-fish, and in severe pain from the two gaping bite wounds they had inflicted. But when he touched the trunk, his mood changed almost instantly. A feeling of warmth, of well-being, of joy flooded his battered body, and there was more.
Do you hear that?
He'd said to Slank, as he slung the trunk. It felt almost weightless onto his shoulder.
Hear what?
Asked Slank.
Bells,
said Little Richard.
You don't hear them?
No, said Slank, eyeing Little Richard sharply. But as they trudged out of the cave, Little Richard still heard the bells, and when they reached the mouth, he noticed something else. The pain from his wounds was gone. He looked down at his forearm and grunted in surprise.
What? Said Slank. Look, said Little Richard, pointing to his arm.
Slank looked. The wound was gone. Where minutes ago there had been mangled flesh and oozing blood, there was only unbroken skin.
My leg too,
said Little Richard, feeling the back of his thigh.
Put down the trunk,
said Slank sharply.
But put it down, now, said Slank.
Little Richard trudged to the beach and set the trunk on the sand. As he released it, the sound of bells faded, died. He reached his hand back toward it.
Leave it alone, said Slank.
Reluctantly, Little Richard withdrew his hand.
I'll stay here with the trunk, said Slank. You go and get the boats. Row the dory back here and tow that pirate's longboat with you. Why don't we just carry the trunk to the boats? Said Little Richard. I don't mind carrying it. Because I don't want you touching it,
thought Slank. But all he said was,
Get them boats, now!
When Little Richard returned with the boats, Slank loaded the trunk into the trailing longboat, then climbed into the dory and ordered Little Richard to row them back to the pirate ship. Slank was feeling very, very good about the way things had worked out. First, and most important, he had the trunk. He had the trunk. He also had the longboat, which meant Black Stash was now marooned on the island. Slank smiled. The fool pirate. He never really knew what he was after, or who he was up against. Slank's plan now was to return to the pirate ship and have Little Richard toss most of the tied-up crew overboard. Keeping just enough men, he'd need only two or three to sail the ship at Pistol Point. And when he got where he was going, he'd get rid of those as well. And, of course, the idiot Little Richard, who knew too much now. Yes, things were looking very, very good, Slank thought. Even the night was pleasant. The sun was down now and the full moon had risen. It hung low over the lagoon, looking impossibly large in the cloudless sky, as though it had drawn closer to Earth to get a better look at this strange island. The light shining from it was bright enough to cast shadows, bright enough that Slank could easily see the deserted beach and the palm trees beyond and the dark mass of the mountains. It was bright enough that, if Slank had been looking at the water behind the longboat, he would have seen something else. A trail of bubbles following them. Getting closer and closer. Chapter 55. A Close Call.
"Hang on!"
shouted Peter.
"I'm scared,"
whimpered Prentice, looking down as they soared over the wall.
"I don't want to fall."
"You won't fall," said Peter.
"You're flying."
And they were, all of them. Molly was first, followed by Peter, who was holding the hand of Prentice, who was holding the hand of James, who was holding the hand of Thomas, who was holding the hand of Tubby Ted, who was holding the huge hand of Alf, who hated heights and had his eyes tight shut. Moments earlier, just after Mr. Grin had floated out of the cage, Peter, urged on by the hovering Molly, had each of the others touched the glowing sphere in his hands. Then he'd snapped the locket shut and ordered them all to hold hands as they began to rise. Peter, the only one with flying experience, followed Molly, gently towing the others over the wall. As they cleared it, he looked down nervously, concerned that the mollusks would use their spears to bring them down. But the surprise appearance of the flying Mr. Grin had plunged the tribe into disarray. The only one remaining by the wall was the old man, fighting Prawn. He stood still, watching, expressionless, as Molly, then Peter and the others, floated into view in the now moonlit sky. Peter's eyes met the old man's.
"I told you," Peter called down. "There's magic."
Fighting Prawn said nothing, only staring back at Peter. Their eyes remained locked for a moment more, then Peter's attention was drawn away by Molly's shout.
"Peter," she said, "we must get back to the beach before it wears off. This way."
She turned and swooped low over the dark jungle.
"All right,"
Peter said to Alf and the boys. "We're going to follow Molly. You need to lean forward, like this." He leaned, and his pull on the others increased.
"Not me,"
said Tubby Ted, looking down nervously.
"I ain't leaning."
Alf, likewise, remained rigidly vertical, petrified with fear. Prentice and Thomas were still too stunned to respond, but James, good old James, was leaning. With his help, Peter was able to get the little hand-holding clock moving, slowly at first, and then picking up speed across the clearing, and then over the treetops. Peter's eyes probed ahead over the moonlit treetops, trying to make out Molly's distant swooping form. Thus absorbed, Peter didn't notice that as they left the clearing, they passed directly over Black Stash and his pirate crew. He didn't see Stash raise a pistol and aim it straight at Peter's heart. It would have been an easy shot. And Stash came this close to pulling the trigger. But much as he wanted to kill the boy, he wanted even more, having seen its power, to find the trunk, and he was sure the boy would lead him to it. Only a few yards away, Fighting Prawn was thinking precisely the same thing. Chapter 56. Capsized. The first time the dory lurched, Slank assumed it was a wave, although if he'd looked around, he'd have seen that the lagoon was dead calm now, its smooth surface turned silver by the brilliant moon rising in the east. But Slank wasn't paying attention to the water. His eyes were locked on the trunk resting in the longboat being towed by the dory. The next time the dory lurched, Slank blamed Little Richard's rowing.
"Stop that!"
Slank complained.
If you'd stop shifting your weight, sir, Little Richard said, we'd make smart time to the ship.
I ain't shifting nothing, Slink said. It's your...
But before he could finish, the longboat rocked violently, nearly taking on water as the trunk slid to the side. Alarmed, Slank lurched to his feet, nearly swamping the dory. He would have gone overboard if Little Richard hadn't turned and grabbed him. Slank lunged for the rope and tried to pull the longboat and the trunk toward him, but it didn't move.
"Give me a hand here," he shouted to Little Richard.
The big man slid next to Slank and leaned over the transom of the dory, which, because of the weight of the two men, was now nearly submerged. The men jerked back suddenly as a hideous gaping mouth of razor-sharp teeth shot hissing from the water.
"It's the mermaids!"
shouted Little Richard as he and Slank tumbled backward in the bouncing dory. The creature came down hard, her teeth sinking into the transom. She twisted her head viciously and tore off a half-moon-shaped piece of wood, leaving a jagged half-moon-shaped space through which water began to spill. As she disappeared, another she-fish attacked to starboard and then another to port, the two rocking the boat in a deadly game of seesaw. Slank rose, trying to scramble away from the she-fish closest to him, only to be smacked hard from behind by the powerful tail of the other, propelling him over the side, his yell for help cut off when he plunged beneath the surface of the lagoon. Slank's sudden departure left the dory unbalanced, and before Little Richard could correct it, the she-fish capsized the boat, dumping the big man into the lagoon as well. The two men thrashed to the surface, struggling to stay afloat in their heavy clothes, weighed down by swords and pistols that they quickly jettisoned and let sink to the bottom. The water boiled ominously around them. Little Richard screamed as he was bitten on his right leg, then his left. Slank, paddling furiously, managed to get to the longboat. As he grabbed the gunwale, he felt the searing pain of teeth sinking into his thigh. He let go of the boat to strike at his attacker, and as he did, the longboat went over, and the trunk tumbled into the lagoon where it floated. Slank lunged for it, but missed.
It was moving.
Sitting atop the water surface, barely an inch of it submerged, the trunk turned left, paused, then right, and finally moved off briskly back toward the island, leaving a V of ripples like a long fading arrow in the silver lagoon. In the middle of the V rose parallel lines of bubbles. Little Richard sputtered to the surface, bleeding, cursing.
"Here!"
called Slank, and Little Richard paddled over. They clung to the longboat, which was lying hull up in the water. Slank lifted his head and squinted across the lagoon. The watery arrow, led by the slowing, shrinking trunk, was heading back into the direction they'd come from, back toward the she-fish cave.
"You think you've won, do you?"
muttered Slank.
"We'll see about that, ladies." "What are we gonna do?"
said Little Richard. In answer, Slank pulled out his locket, then said,
"How are you
with heights?" Chapter 57 An Old Friend. Peter and the others just made it to the beach. The star stuff began wearing off while they were still over the jungle. For a few moments, Peter thought they would be plunged into the thick, dark vegetation underlying the moonlit tree canopy. He didn't relish the thought of being lost in there at night. But with James's help, Peter was able to drag the little hand-holding group of reluctant flyers into one last swoop and soar, and this time, as they reached the apex of their upward curve, he heard Molly just ahead shouting and pointing, and then saw, to his great relief, the white of the beach looking like snow under the startlingly bright moon.
"Hang on!" he shouted. "We're coming down over there!"
They just cleared the last set of palms. In fact, Alf's feet brushed the highest one, sending a coconut thudding to the sand. And then they crash-landed onto the beach, tumbling and rolling a few yards from where Molly was waiting. They were at the edge of a sandy cove, bounded on either side by steep, rocky hillsides. For a moment, Alf, James, Prentice, Thomas, and Tubby Ted stood speechless, brushing off sand and absorbing their disbelief at their flight, and relief at being on the ground again. Then the question started.
"How did we do that?" asked Prentice. "How could we? I mean..."
"And the crocodile,"
interrupted Thomas. "How did..."
"I'm hungry," said Tubby Ted. "Is there any..."
"And that thing," said James. "That thing we touched. What was it? It felt so..."
"It was a trunk, wasn't it, lad?"
said Alf.
"You must have..."
"Can we fly again?"
said James.
"Yes,"
said Prentice and Thomas simultaneously. "We want to..."
All right, said Peter. I'll try to explain, though it's a bit, strange. But first I have to... listen, just wait here a minute.
Peter walked to where Molly was standing, watching him, her expression blank as he approached.
You came back, he said, to rescue me.
He blushed.
I mean, us.
Yes,
she said.
Thank you,
he said. Molly didn't answer.
But you said you couldn't, Peter said. You said you had to get the trunk. You said that was the most important thing.
It is, she said, and I should have left you.
Now what little star stuff was left in that locket is probably gone. And it's night, and the pirates are on the island, and I fear they already have the trunk. It's been moving, Peter. I've felt it. Somebody has found it, and whoever it is won't want us to have it. And now those natives will be after us, and that crocodile is loose somewhere, and I'm just afraid it's hopeless.
Peter saw she was crying. He wanted to hug her, but he couldn't, not with Alf and the others watching. He settled for patting her shoulder.
It'll be all right, he said. We'll find the trunk.
Molly forced a wan smile.
I appreciate that, Peter. I know you want to help, but at this point I honestly don't know what to do.
You say you can feel the trunk, said Peter.
Yes.
Do you know what direction it's in?
No, only that it's moving.
Well, if it is, then somebody's moving it, and perhaps we'll be able to see it. In the morning we'll climb that mountain again and have a look. Molly nodded.
I suppose that's as good a plan as any.
In the meanwhile, said Peter, we need to get some sleep if we can. We can set up a watch in case somebody comes along, or that thing. He shuddered, thinking about Mr. Grin.
All right,
said Molly, her spirits picking up a bit now that they had a plan. And I should give you this back, said Peter, reaching for the locket around his neck. You might...
Did you hear that?
Molly said, her hand on Peter's arm.
What?
Said Peter. I didn't...
Shh, hissed Molly.
She cocked her head, listening, then smiled.
It's him,
she said, tossing the words back over her shoulder as she was already running toward the water.
Who?
Said Peter, running to catch her. But her attention was focused ahead, and the sounds she was making were not intended for him. And then Peter saw a familiar shape, a blunt and grinning snout sticking up from the moonlit wavelets, perhaps 10 yards offshore, clicking and chittering in return.
Arm! Peter shouted.
Chapter 58. Crossroads. Beneath a thick tree canopy ringed with monkey howls and other jungle sounds, Black Stash led his band of pirates, following a path that meandered in the general direction that the flying children and Mr. Grin had gone. Smee, jumping at every sound, said,
Captain, what if that humongous flying lizard landed somewheres ahead here?
Weren't no lizard,
said Stash over his shoulder.
That was a croc.
Whatever it was, Captain, said Smee, it might be up ahead here. Maybe we should...
He stopped, because Stash had turned, scowling.
Maybe we should what, Smee?
Well, Captain,
stammered Smee.
With that thing flying around here, and those children, them flying too. It's just all so strange on this island, Captain. And it being night and all, me and the men here, we thought maybe if we waited till daylight, we could...
You thought?
Interrupted Stash.
You thought?
He glared at Smee, then at the men standing nervously behind him.
Yes,
began Smee.
You don't think,
thundered Stash, causing Smee and the others to jump like a gaggle of puppets, all attached to the same string.
I do the thinking. You understand?
Aye, Captain,
came the chorus of replies.
Good,
said Stash, and resumed walking. The fact was, Stash, although he would never let his men know, was also quite uneasy about going the same direction as the croc. He was not fond of crocs, having fed people to the beasts on a number of occasions and seen firsthand the terrible things their jaws could do. And a croc of this monstrous size, flying. No, Stash did not relish encountering the thing, but he had to find those children. Flying children. He had no doubts about it now. They can fly. And Stash meant to have the source of that power. Overhead the thick tangle opened a bit, and then more. The full tropical moon shining down, nearly as bright as the English sun, illuminating a clearing where two paths intersected. A jungle crossroads. Stash considered the paths.
Crenshaw, Bates,
he said. Two men stepped reluctantly forward.
You two are volunteering for the scouting party, said Stash. Crenshaw, take this path to the south. Bates, you'll head west. You listen, and you look, but you will not be heard, and you will not be seen. Am I clear on that?
Aye.
Aye, Captain. We're looking for them kids, or the treasure, or both. You report back to me the moment you see anything of interest. You have till the moon straight overhead. Then we'll be taking the south path. That's toward you, Crenshaw. Am I clear on that?
He didn't wait for the answers.
Go.
As the two scouts trotted off, unhappily, in different directions into the dark jungle, Stash and his men made themselves comfortable in the moonlit clearing. Nobody spoke, but each man, Stash included, was thinking the same thing.
I'm glad it's not me going out there alone.
Chapter 59 Arm's Message. Peter trotted down the beach toward Molly, who was now waist-deep in the moonlit cove, squeaking and chittering as she waded toward the upthrust, grinning snout of Arm. James, trotting alongside Peter, said,
What is it? What's she doing?
She's talking to the porpoise, said Peter. His name is Arm.
Fish can talk, said James.
This one can, said Peter.
What's it saying?
Said James as they reached the water's edge.
I don't know, said Peter. I don't speak porpoise, but Molly does. She'll tell us.
They were now standing next to Molly with Arm several feet in front of them, listening politely. Molly, desperate for news from her father, forced herself to remember the mandatory opening formalities of porpoise talk.
Greetings, she said.
Greetings, said Arm.
Molly teeth green, said Molly.
Yes, agreed Arm. Molly teeth green.
Molly happy sea Arm, she said.
The porpoise language has 237 words that mean happy. And Molly had actually chosen the one denoting the happiness derived from having one's belly tickled by seaweed. Arm doubted that Molly was feeling this particular happiness, but out of politeness used the same word in responding.
Arm, happy, see, Molly, he said.
With the formalities concluded, Molly took a breath and frowned in concentration, not wanting to make any mistakes as she got to the critical question.
Molly, father, come?
Arm paused for several moments, during which Molly did not breathe. Then Arm said,
Yes, Molly, father, come.
Molly exhaled and, in English, said,
Thank heaven.
What?
Said Peter.
He says my father is coming,
said Molly.
When?
Said Peter.
I don't know,
said Molly. Switching back to porpoise, she said,
When Molly, father, come?
Day,
said Arm. Molly frowned.
What day?
Arm hesitated, as if confused by the question, then repeated,
Day.
Day,
said Molly.
Day,
said Arm.
What's he saying?
Said Peter.
I'm not actually sure, said Molly. I think he's saying day, but my porpoise is not very good, and the porpoise language is vague about time. If he is saying day, he could mean my father is coming tomorrow, but thinks he could also be saying it will be more days.
I hope he means tomorrow, said Peter.
Yes, said Molly, but even that might be too late. If the pirates have the trunk, we must...
She was interrupted by more chittering from Arm. Molly listened, struggling to follow the sounds. The only part she caught was bad man.
Again, please, she said.
Arm spoke again more deliberately. This time Molly caught bad man again and light. Molly pondered that.
Light? What could he mean by...
Oh, no,
she said.
What, said Peter.
I think he's saying the pirates have the trunk,
said Molly. Does he know where they are, said Peter.
Where, Batman?
Molly asked Arm.
Where, light?
Molly, come,
said Arm. He darted a few yards to the left, toward the rocky wave-lash point to the left of the cove, then repeated,
Molly, come.
He wants us to follow, said Molly.
To Arm, she said,
Molly, come.
Arm whirled and plunged into the water, surfacing just moments later 25 yards further along the beach toward the point of land, chittering, "Come!" Peter and James followed, trotting diagonally back to the beach, then on a parallel course with the porpoise, who kept popping up to make sure they were with him. Alf and the other boys, though mystified, trotted along behind.
"What are we doing, lad?" panted Alf.
"Following the porpoise," said Peter.
"But why?"
shouted Tubby Ted, bringing up the rear.
"It's a talking porpoise," shouted James. "It's taking us to the treasure."
"It's what?"
said Alf and Tubby Ted at the same time.
"He's right," said Peter over his shoulder.
"But who has a treasure? It's them pirates, is that it, lad?"
Alf questioned.
"Yes, we think so," Peter admitted. "And we, I mean Molly, has to get the trunk back from them."
"Well then, why didn't you say so? I wouldn't miss it,"
said Alf.
"Seem,"
said James. Thomas and Prentice said nothing, but not wanting to be left alone on this increasingly strange island, trotted along with the group, as did the panting, incessantly complaining Tubby Ted. They trotted for 100 yards, at which point the beach curved sharply to the right, along a steeply rising lava slope. At the end lay the point where huge ocean rollers, having travelled unhampered across thousands of miles of open ocean, slammed thunderingly into massive lava formations, sending spray high into the air. Arm continued to follow the coast, heading out toward the end of the point. On shore, the little band of humans followed, but as the hard-packed beach sand gave way to sharp, treacherously hole-ridden lava, the footing instantly became near impossible, and the going very slow. Peter stopped for a moment and studied the slope.
"Look," he said to Molly. "Arm has to swim round that point. He can't use the land, but we can. It would be a lot quicker for us to just climb this hill and meet him at the water on the other side."
Molly considered the hill, then shook her head.
"We don't know what's on the other side of this hill. It might be another cove, but it might also be more island. We could be back in the jungle and lost. Besides, Arm may be leading us to the end of this point."
"But we can't keep up with him, not on these rocks," said Peter.
He gestured toward the others, who were picking their way over the dark lava, rock by rock, with agonizing slowness. Arm was far ahead now, an intermittent speck of light grey in the dark roiling water.
"I've got to try and stay with him," said Molly. "I don't dare lose him."
"All right then," said Peter. "I'll climb this hill and see what I see. Water or land, either way, I'll come back and tell you." Molly looked doubtful.
"You'll come right back," she said.
"I'll find you," he said. Their eyes met for a moment.
"All right," she said.
And with that, Peter was gone, clambering up the steep, rocky hillside, leaving the others to struggle along in pursuit of Arm, wherever he was leading them. Chapter 60. Too quick for a cloud, too big for a bird. Barely rippling the surface, the trunk glided toward the waterfall at the mouth of the lagoon. The brackish water grew clear so that from above, long, powerful green tails could be seen propelling the trunk, as the mermaids triumphantly bore their prize back to their lair. Feeling safe now, they raised their heads from the water. The one in the lead, the others called her in their strange, throaty language, teacher, turned and smiled at her school. Her long, thick hair was blonde. Her teeth, white and even, were human now. Exposure to the trunk having completed her transformation from fish to mermaid. The other mermaids smiled back at her, human teeth, all. So elated were they by their triumph, so absorbed with their prize, their creator, that only one of them, a young mermaid in the back of the school, happened to see the thing that flew across the face of the moon. Too quick for a cloud, too big for a bird. She grunted an alarm and slapped her tail twice on the water surface. The other mermaids responded instantly, diving in fright. All but Teacher, who would not leave the creator. She wrapped her arms around the trunk defiantly and looked up at the blackened silhouette swooping toward her. She recognized it at once and snarled.
"Lean forward,"
shouted Slank from the bow of the flying longboat. He was still getting the feel of it, his ability to steer shaky and imprecise. In the bright moonlight he could clearly see his target below, as well as the blonde-haired she-fish hissing up at him. At the stern, little Richard, gripping both sides in terror, shifted his weight slightly forward as the longboat dove. Slank leaned to port, lining up the bow with his target.
"Steady,"
Steady!
The boat hurtled downward. The mermaid did not move.
She's brave. I'll give her that.
As the boat was about to hit the water, Slank leaned back. The bow lifted slightly, avoiding a direct collision with the trunk, but striking the defiant mermaid. Slank felt the thud in his feet.
That's one less to worry about.
The longboat splashed down into the lagoon, its sharp bow sending up waves on either side. Slank and Little Richard tumbled to the bottom of the boat, which rocked violently for a moment, but did not capsize.
The trunk!
Slank shouted, struggling to his feet.
There,
said Little Richard, pointing. The trunk bobbed in the water astern. Slank thought about diving in after it, but quickly changed his mind.
Sheafish.
There were a dozen or more of them between the boat and the trunk, diving and surfacing frantically, apparently searching for something. It took Slank a moment, but then he understood.
They're looking for the one I hit.
Whirling, Slank lunged to the bow and looked into the water.
There she is.
Her body was wedged under the prow, floating motionless. Slank grabbed her by the arm and dragged her into the boat. Her face was covered with blood. She was breathing, but barely. Suddenly there was a wail from the water and then more. The mermaids had caught sight of their wounded sister and were surrounding the boat, snarling.
Throw her back,
shouted Little Richard.
They'll capsize us again.
No,
shouted Slank, drawing his knife.
She's our barter.
He grabbed the unconscious mermaid and hauled her upright, holding the knife at her neck. The mermaids wailed and keened in horror.
Listen,
shouted Slank.
I give her to you.
He made a gesture of throwing her over the side.
And you give me that.
He pointed at the trunk.
You understand?
The mermaids showed no sign of comprehending. Instead, responding to some signal neither man heard or saw, the mermaids flashed their tails and disappeared, leaving only ripples. 5 seconds passed. 10.
I don't like this,
said Little Richard.
Get your whip,
said Slank, dropping the unconscious mermaid at the bow. Little Richard uncoiled the bullwhip he kept wrapped around his waist.
Here they come,
he said. The two men crouched, watching the water. Suddenly the dark, shifting shapes shot up at them through the moonlit water.
Here they come,
Slank said. In a flash of tails, the mermaid slammed the boat, rocking it violently. Slank stabbed blindly down into the water. Little Richard's whip cracked once, twice, but he too was having trouble drawing a bead on the swiftly moving creatures. The boat rocked again. Again, Slank stabbed at the water, this time driving several of the creatures back, but only for a moment. The mermaids came at them again, then again. Slank and Little Richard lunged frantically back and forth in the boat, grunting, shouting, trying to keep them at bay, trying to keep the wildly gyrating boat from going over. From time to time, the knife cut, or the whip connected, each time drawing a scream. The water around the longboat grew cloudy with blood, but the mermaids kept coming, coming, frothing the water around the unsteady longboat.
There!
Slank shouted, pointing, as the mermaids, working together, massed for an attack at the stern. Their goal being to pull the transom underwater with their weight. A lash from Little Richard's whip drove them off, sent the bow splashing down, and causing Slank to fall. Rising, he looked behind him to see that the wounded mermaid was gone. She had either slipped or fallen back into the water. The other mermaids, still battling Little Richard at the stern, apparently had not noticed. Slank searched the blood-clouded water around the bow, but saw no sign of the wounded mermaid. Meanwhile, as Slank peered into the water at the bow, and Little Richard battled the mermaids at the stern, the trunk, momentarily forgotten by all of them, drifted farther and farther from the longboat into the night. Chapter 61. Crenshaw Returns. Black Stash held up a hand, silently stopping Smee and the others, and signaled them off the jungle path. Stash, too, stepped aside, concealing himself amid the enormous leaves of a plant. The sounds of someone running drew closer.
A native?
Stash crouched and laid his sword across the path. When the runner was upon him, Stash lifted the sword a few inches, and the runner, with a cry of pain, sprawled face first onto the ground.
Crenshaw!
Said Stash, stepping out.
Captain!
Said Crenshaw, out of breath. He hurried painfully to his feet.
Well, man?
Said Stash.
What is it?
Crenshaw attempted to answer.
I seen that lizard,
said Smee, interrupting.
"Shut up, Smee," said Stash. "Crenshaw?"
"The longboat, Captain," said Crenshaw, still gasping for breath.
"The longboat?"
said Stash, bewildered.
"Our longboat?"
By his recollection, it should have been well down the island.
"Yes, sir, I seen it just now."
"Where?"
"It was flying, Captain."
"It was what?"
"Flying, Captain, up in the air, like a bird. But it weren't no bird. It were the longboat, sure as I'm standing here."
The other pirates gathered around now, muttering about this strange and unlucky island, where things kept flying that were not supposed to fly.
"Belay that talk," said Stash. "Crenshaw, where did you see this flying longboat?"
"Up this path where you sent me. It leads to a beach, a lagoon, sir. I'd just gotten there when I sees the longboat pass right in front of the moon, plain as anything, and there was men in it."
More muttering from the crew.
"I said belay it,"
said Stash.
To Crenshaw he said, "How many men? What men?"
"Two, I reckon. One of them, big as fright he was, right across the moon. They flied, fast as a bird they was. But it weren't no bird, it was a flying..."
"Yes, yes, a longboat,"
said Stash, eyeing Crenshaw curiously.
"And where exactly did this longboat go?"
"Oh, I can't say for certain, Captain. There were trees and such in me way. It went from this ways to that,"
he said, indicating right to left.
"Went past the moon and headed down."
"Down?"
"Yes, Captain, down, I reckon, toward the water."
"What about the trunk, the treasure?"
"Didn't see nothing of the sort, just the flying longboat. She went past, and I turned eye tail to run back to tell you, and then you tripped me up, and then you asked me what I'd seen, and then I..."
"I know this part, you idiot."
"Yes, sir."
Stash reviewed the situation. The trunk could not be far off, that was for certain. When things started flying that should not be flying, the trunk had to be near. But who were these two men, and what were they doing in his longboat?
"All right, men," said Stash. "We double time down to this lagoon. Crenshaw, you lead the way, and show us where you've seen this flying longboat. Move!"
Trotting with a pronounced limp, Crenshaw headed back down the path, followed by Stash, and somewhat more reluctantly, Smee and the others. In a few minutes, the path widened. Patches of low fog shone in the moonlight like tiny puffs of grey cotton. Crenshaw had left out mention of the swirling fog. Stash smelled the lagoon before he saw it, like a fresh rainfall. From far to his left came the trickling sound of water, a stream, and waterfall that fed the lagoon. Then, above the sounds of the water, he heard distinctly human sounds. Grunting, shouting, splashing, the crack of a whip. Familiar sounds to a pirate.
Fighting.
The path led to a small sand dune. Stash stopped his men short. By the sound of it, the fight was raging in the water, just on the other side.
"No reason to join a fight unless you know what side you're on."
Another crack of the whip, then a scream, a woman's scream. His men stopped, all eyes on Stash.
"Here's what we do,"
he whispered.
"Whoever's out there, we let them kill each other off. When they're done and the fighting stops, we'll take care of whoever's left. Get your weapons ready."
He was thinking,
"Flying boats and fighting. The treasure's at the heart of this."
Then, drawing his sword, Stash began to creep up the side of the dune. Chapter 62. Peter's Decision. Peter's hands were bleeding, sliced time and again by the jagged lava as he fought his way up the hillside. As he neared the top, the slope became very steep, almost vertical, causing Peter to question the wisdom of his plan. He periodically glanced back down along the hillside, but could no longer see Molly or the others. He wondered if he'd be able to find them again. Finally, he reached the top and saw immediately that his suspicion had been correct. The hill was, in fact, a narrow neck separating the cove from a wide, curved lagoon. The slope on the other side of the hill was as steep as the one he had ascended, leading down to another beach. He swept his gaze along it, starting on the far right, seeing nothing of interest until some huge rock formations in the center of the lagoon curve near the beach. He focused on these, his eyes straining to pick up details in the moonlight.
After a moment, he saw it, a slim, dark shape on the silver water. A boat. Peter squinted. There were people in the boat. There was commotion around it. Pirates. He was sure of it. Who else could it be? And they've got the trunk, I wager. Peter considered the situation. He was certain that Arm, forced to take the water route, was leading Molly around the point to this boat. He decided it made no sense for him to go back down the way he had come over the rough lava and try to catch up with Molly. Obviously, he should proceed down to this new beach and wait for the others there. So he descended, finding the going down much quicker than the climbing up had been. He stood on the beach for 5 long minutes, then 5 more, then 5 more, peering down the beach to his right, waiting impatiently for Molly and the others to come into view, remembering how slow their progress had been when he'd left them. Finally, his impatience got the better of him. "I'll just go down and have a look," he thought. And so he set off, keeping out of the moonlight, staying under the tall palms that edged the beach, trotting toward the big rocks and the longboat. Chapter 63. Gone Again. 4 distinct V's appeared in the moonlit water, all aimed at the port side of the longboat.
"Broadsides!" Slank called out.
Too late. The mermaids timed their strike perfectly, lifting the port side high as Little Richard was leaning the wrong way. He fell, flailing, and his massive weight flipped the boat, catapulting Slank into the air and then into the lagoon. Slank bobbed to the surface, frantically stabbing into the water and thrashing with his legs, expecting at any second to feel mermaid teeth sink into his flesh. Instead, he felt the bottom. During the fight, the boat had drifted within 10 yards of shore. Slank could stand easily. Little Richard was also standing, peering nervously at the water, whip at the ready.
"Where'd they go?"
he asked. Slank looked around, seeing no sign of tails or splashes, only the now gentle lagoon surface, mirroring the moon. Then it hit him.
"Where's the trunk?"
he said. The two men spun in circles. Gone. Again. Slank spat a curse at the sky, then took a deep breath.
"All right," he said. "Let's get the boat ashore."
They grabbed the swamped longboat, walked it to the beach, dumped the water out, and hauled the boat onto the sand.
"I don't get it,"
panted Little Richard when they were done.
"They was after us like banshees, then they was gone."
Slank had been thinking about that.
"They was trying to rescue the one I had in the boat," he said. "That's why they capsized us. But then they saw she wasn't there and went looking for her. It's the only explanation."
"But where'd she go?"
Little Richard asked.
"I don't care where she went," Slank said. "What I care about is the trunk, and I'm thinking if we didn't see it drift off, them she-devils didn't see it neither."
Slank was studying the lagoon intently now, hands on hips. To the left, fresh water poured in over the waterfall and swirled in a deep pool by the island of rocks. Watching the movement of the foam, Slank detected a slight current moving to the right, down the curve of the beach.
"Come on,"
he said, setting off at a trot.
"Where are we going now?"
said Little Richard, none too happy, lumbering behind.
"If the trunk comes ashore," said Slank, "it'll be this way."
Chapter 64. He surely will. Keeping to the mooncast shadows beneath the palms, Peter trotted along the beach toward the longboat. As he drew closer, he heard angry shouts and a cracking sound, as well as other, stranger noises, and saw figures in and around the boat in frenzied activity, apparently fighting. Who would the pirates be fighting? He stopped and looked back toward the rocky point. There was still no sign of Arm or Molly.
It's taking them forever.
Peter hesitated. On the one hand, he was reluctant to get too close to the battle ahead and risk capture. On the other hand, he was very curious to know who was fighting the pirates and where the trunk was. He decided he could risk getting a little closer. He had walked no more than 20 feet when he heard it, a moan coming from his right at the water's edge. He stopped and heard it again, louder this time. He glanced ahead at the shouting figures, then, keeping his head low, darted down the beach to the water. He saw her immediately, a girl lying face down in the shallow water, her long blonde hair splayed forward, touching the sand. She appeared to be struggling to crawl onto the beach. Her arms moved feebly, her hands clawing at the wet sand. Peter ran to the girl, dropping to his knees into the water. He took her by the shoulders and turned her over, and immediately noticed several things. The first was that she was startlingly beautiful, with astonishingly large, luminescent green eyes. The second was that she did not appear to be wearing any clothes, her only covering coming from her lush cascade of hair. Ordinarily, this second thing would have gotten Peter's full attention, but he was much distracted by the third thing, which was blood seeping from a deep gash in her forehead. Supporting the girl's head in his hands, Peter looked frantically around for something to put over the wound. "My shirt," he thought. He decided to pull the girl further up on the sand, so he could rest her head on the beach while he removed his shirt. Getting his hand under her arms, he heaved backward. That was when Peter noticed a fourth, even more startling thing. She had a tail.
"Ah!"
said Peter, jumping up, dropping her head. The girl, or fish, or whatever she was, moaned piteously and writhed in pain. Peter stood over her, water dripping from his body.
Who are you?"
he said. The mermaid did not answer, but blinked and looked at Peter as if seeing him for the first time.
"Those eyes."
She drew a sharp breath, her expression suddenly fearful.
"It's okay,"
said Peter, softly kneeling again.
"I won't hurt you."
The mermaid's expression remained wary, but her large eyes closed again. Peter saw she was weakening rapidly as her blood, dark in the moonlight, continued to ooze onto the sand.
"I'm going to put a bandage on you," Peter said, untucking his shirt. "You'll be fine."
But she didn't seem to hear him. Her head had slumped sideways now, and the life seemed to be slowly draining from her face. Peter felt certain it was too late for a bandage to do much good, but not knowing what else to do, he began to pull his shirt over his head, only to get it tangled in
the locket.
Peter slipped it off his neck and looked at it. He'd meant to give it back to Molly, but then Arm had appeared, and in the excitement he'd forgotten. He had no idea how much, if any, star stuff was left in it. If there was any, it likely wasn't much.
Should I save it? I might need it against the pirates. Molly might need it.
The mermaid moaned again, a weak sound, a dying sound. Peter looked at her face, then at the locket, then down at the still empty beach toward the rocky point.
"I'm sorry, Molly."
He whispered the apology, then snapped open the locket. Immediately a sphere of golden light blinded him. First his hands, then the rest of his body, experienced the now familiar warmth and feeling of well-being. Peter wanted to luxuriate in that feeling, but forced himself to invert the locket and pour its contents onto the mermaid's wounded forehead. The warmth quickly drained out of him. The glow spread over the girl's body, then disappeared, like water absorbed by a sponge.
"It's working."
In a moment, the glow was gone. Peter picked up the locket. It still hung open, but was now just lifeless metal. He snapped it shut and put it back around his neck. He found himself aware of the silence. The splashing and shouting from down the beach had stopped. He started to rise to have a look, when he felt a hand grip his forearm. Startled, he whirled and saw the mermaid was sitting up, her eyes open and focused on Peter. Her wound was gone.
"Are you all right?" Peter asked.
The girl said nothing but reached her hand out and gently traced her fingers along the side of Peter's face. He blushed. She smiled, a stunningly beautiful smile. As they stared at each other, Peter heard a splash a few yards offshore and, looking up, saw not one, but two, no, three more mermaids. Waist high in the shallow water, they hissed at him and dragged themselves forward. Peter tried to scramble away, but the blonde mermaid made an odd, deep-throated sound, and they stopped their advance. An exchange of strange sounds followed. The three other mermaids smiled at Peter, who blushed even more. This pleasant scene was interrupted by the sudden surfacing of yet another mermaid who, with barely a glance at Peter, emitted a rapid series of throaty sounds that clearly excited and alarmed the three others. They whirled and, with a flash of their green tails, were gone underwater. The mermaid whom Peter had rescued hesitated only a moment longer, giving Peter's arm one final squeeze. She offered another radiant smile, slid gracefully forward into the water, and then she too was gone. Seconds later, the whole group of mermaids surfaced 20 yards to Peter's left, making sounds, gesticulating excitedly to one another. Peter stood on his tiptoes, but couldn't see. He ran up the beach and looked back. The mermaids were trying to work their way through the shallows to a dark form lying, wave-lapped, at the water's edge. Peter blinked, not believing his luck. The trunk! Unguarded! Racing through the shallow water, he reached it in seconds. There was no question. Even in the brilliant moonlight, he could see the glow through the cracks. The moment his hand touched the rough wood, he felt the familiar warmth. His attention was drawn away by urgent sounds out in the lagoon. The mermaids, struggling frantically to make their way to him, were waving their arms and flopping their now useless tails through the shallow water. The blonde mermaid he'd saved was in front. Her eyes met his as she made a series of urgent but incomprehensible sounds, clearly trying to tell him something.
"What is it?" called Peter. "What? Ooh!"
The club-like wooden handle of Little Richard's whip, 2 feet of 2-inch diameter oak, slammed into Peter's skull from behind. Peter instantly crumpled to the shallow water, unable to break his fall, and lay face down, motionless. The mermaids, hissing, lunged forward with teeth bared, but were at a hopeless disadvantage in the shallow water, and scurried back as the whip cracked out at them.
"Forget them," said Slank. "They can't reach us here. Get the trunk. We're going back to the longboat." "But if we're in the boat, those things'll swamp us again," said Little Richard, gesturing at mermaids. "Not this time," said Slank. "With what's in the trunk, we can leave the way we come in, flying over them she-devils."
He laughed at the mermaids, who were highly agitated. He noticed that one of them, the blonde one, was, despite the risk of the whip, crawling toward Peter, who had not moved.
"Oh, you fancy this lad, do you?"
he asked.
"You're welcome to him."
With his right foot, he gave Peter's motionless form, still face down, a shove toward the deeper water.
"Get the trunk," said Slank to Little Richard, "and let's get off this miserable island."
Little Richard hoisted the trunk to his shoulder, then glanced down at Peter.
"Shouldn't we turn the boy over?" he called to Slank. "If we leave him like that, he'll surely drown."
"Oh, yes,"
said Slank, not looking back.
"He surely will."
Chapter 65. He's Gone Ahead.
"Come on,"
called Molly to the others for what felt to her like the 100th time.
"Can't you go any faster?"
They were picking their way with agonizing slowness along the rocky wave-lash point, trying to keep from falling on the slippery, irregular, razor-sharp coral, their legs now covered with scrapes and bleeding cuts. Right behind Molly, as had been from the start, walked James, steady James. But the others lagged at a considerable distance, Prentice and Thomas both miserable but gamely struggling forward, and Alf far to the rear, now essentially carrying Tubby Ted. Molly had been tempted more than once to leave them behind, but could not bring herself to abandon them. Even with the big sailor to look after them, this strange and scary island required everyone to stick together.
"Peter should never have gone off on his own."
She looked ahead and to the right, her eyes searching just beyond the breakers, until she caught sight of Arm, his snout appearing almost white in the moonlight, chittering at her to come, come, come. Peter had been right. Arm had led them around the point only because he could not lead them by land. The destination was clearly the broad lagoon that now came into view. Molly assumed this meant that Peter was ahead of them, somewhere on the beach by now. She hoped that for once he would show some patience and wait for her as planned. At last the terrain improved, the unforgiving lava giving way to rock and sand. Molly scanned the broad, sweeping curve of beach, but saw no sign of Peter.
"Where are you?"
she wondered. She glanced back at the others.
"Come on,"
she called out, for what felt like the 101st time. Then, urged on by the chittering Arm, she began trotting along the hard-packed sand, still searching through the night for Peter.
"I hope you haven't gotten yourself into trouble."
Chapter 66. The Dream. Peter had never kissed a girl. He had never kissed anybody, at least not technically. Not that he remembered. He did have a memory, dim and dreamlike, of being kissed, but that was by a grown-up, a lady. When he recalled this memory, which he sometimes did as he was falling off to sleep, he thought that perhaps the lady might have been his mother. He tried to see her face, but the memory wouldn't allow it. It felt more like a shadow, old and faded by the light. But he had never kissed a girl. He'd read of it, this girl kissing. He had heard the older boys at St. Norbert snicker about it. For most of his life, Peter had not understood why anyone, girl or boy, would want to do such an unappetizing thing as put their mouths together. Lately, though, since he'd met Molly, the idea seemed less and less repulsive, and more intriguing. But still, he had never done it, had never come close. So he was sure that he was dreaming now, in this strange and unreal moment, in this weightless watery tumble, in this swirl of light, in this burble of strange noises. He must be dreaming, because he was in the arms of a girl, a very beautiful girl, with blonde hair and green eyes. Molly has green eyes. And this beautiful girl was holding him, and her mouth was touching his mouth, and, the strangest thing, her breath was becoming Peter's breath. The strangest thing, a dream, certainly, but it was a pleasant dream. And Peter decided the best thing to do was simply let go and enjoy it. Chapter 67. The Power. Slank looked back at little Richard, expecting to see him complaining under the weight of the trunk. Instead, the big man had a wide grin on his face, and his strides were enormous, 6 or 8 feet at a step, as if...
"Are you all right?" Slank said.
"Never better," said little Richard,
taking a step that easily carried him 15 feet before he drifted to a gentle landing. That did it. Slank, trotting alongside, grabbed little Richard's shirt to prevent him from flying away. With the contact, Slank's arm immediately felt warm, a little ticklish.
"I'm fine, really," little Richard said.
"Perfect. I can see that.
I could start singing."
"No, you don't," Slank hissed.
Little Richard hummed instead, the smile never leaving his face. Slank thought about carrying the trunk himself, but feared that he too would fall under its spell and be unable to think clearly. So instead he acted as little Richard's ballast, holding the big man down as though he were a human balloon. The two of them bounced and drifted along the beach until, to Slank's relief, they reached the longboat.
"Push it down," said Slank.
Little Richard, his feet were a foot off the ground now, gave Slank a hurt puppy look.
"But why?"
he asked.
"Why would I want to do that?"
"Put it down, now,"
Slank ordered. Little Richard reluctantly obeyed, gently setting the trunk onto the sand. He looked at it wistfully.
"Now what?" he said.
"Now,"
said Slank, sloshing around in the shallow water,
"we find a rock. Here, this one will do."
Grunting, he hefted the rock and waded ashore.
"What are you going to do?"
said little Richard.
"Open the trunk," said Slank.
"Good,"
said little Richard.
"I'm not opening it so you can amuse yourself," snapped Slank. "I'm opening it so we can get this boat flying again and get back to the ship without being swamped by them she-devils. You're not to touch the contents. You understand?"
"Yes,"
said little Richard, a hurt puppy again. Ignoring the trunk's formidably padlocked clasp, Slank focused his efforts on the 2 old iron hinges. He smashed the rock down on the first. It cracked easily, and on the second blow fell off completely. He turned to the second hinge, and on the first blow it nearly came free, a puff of golden powder shooting from the widening lid crack and landing on the sand at Slank's feet.
"One more blow should do it."
Slank had raised the rock when he heard the bellow of surprise from little Richard. He whirled just in time to see a wooden club coming straight for his head. He dodged it, diving to the sand, rolling and jumping up.
"Pirates!"
2 of them had jumped little Richard from behind. But 2 men were no match for him. He rocked forward and easily tossed them head over heels onto the sand. Slank had his dagger out now, its blade flashing in the moonlight. But before he could use it, he felt a sharp point of a sword pressing into the back of his neck, felt a trickle of his own blood.
"Drop it or die,"
said Blackstache. Slank let the dagger fall.
"Now, tell your friend to stop fighting,"
said Stash, nodding toward little Richard, who was currently getting the best of 3 pirates.
"Little Richard,"
Slank called out,
"that's enough."
The huge man, as always, obeyed.
"Tie them up,"
said Stash.
"Use the line from the longboat."
In a minute Stash's men had Slank and Little Richard lying on the beach, arms and legs firmly bound behind their backs.
"You ain't going to kill them, Captain," said Smee.
"No need for us to do it with the tide."